or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
Imagine I told you there was a career that had prestige, six-figure salary, job market's good, completely pro-social mission, and yet one-fifth of everybody in that profession left that profession in the first year or two. You'd wonder what that profession is. It's school principal. What's it really like to be a school principal? Well, I picked a very interesting character to come on the show to tell us about that. Not just because I met him and I found him a straight-shooting interesting guy, but there was a nationwide search done recently, a couple years ago, to find the principal for one of California's newest, and depending upon your term, either most expensive, boondoggly, or ambitious project, whatever you prefer to call it, $165 million building, highly tech, high green, state-of-the-art, just north of Vallejo, and a little place called American Canyon, very diverse community. And this guy was the winner of that national search. So in addition to being an interesting guy, straight-shooting guy, he's gotten one of the plum jobs in California. Not an average guy at all. So without further ado, Mark Brewer, welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
Thank you, Marty. Welcome. It's good to be on the show.
It is my pleasure to have you. So, there is a lot of turnover among principals. Why?
I think from what I know in the context I work in, a lot of people leave the profession, or the turnover rate comes just due to the demands of the job. It's a very demanding job.
How so?
Just the daily ins and outs. You take, for our case, 1,400 adolescent teenagers and put them in a facility mm-hmm. with you all day long, every day. We typically see them during the year more than their parents do. And with that comes all the other things with adolescents.
Like what?
All the challenges of kids behaving, kids being focused, kids being engaged, wanting to be at school, wanting to participate, wanting to learn, providing athletic programs and other things that will tie them to the school.
We were joking before the show. You said you actually, or one of your minions caught two kids actually having sex in the hall.
Yes, we've had those experiences in the past. I tell people I've been a high school administrator for about 16 years now, and I'm always telling people that the second you say you've seen it all, something else will surprise you, because they're teenagers. They're trying to develop and find their way in life, and it's an interesting time to interact with young adults.
You started being a school administrator 16 years ago. You also taught for 10 years before that. Have, in your judgment, have the schools changed? Would you have been as likely to see two kids having sex in the hall 16 years ago, or have things changed in your judgment?
I think you're just as likely to see the same kinds of behavior from adolescents. I don't think that's changed over the years I've been involved in public education. I think what's changed is the way they learn, the way they perceive the world and how they interact with the world.
How do you mean?
It's very different. They're all tied to different kinds of technology now, social media, and different ways to communicate and absorb information. And I think the challenge that we need to look in the future towards with public education is, how do we innovate to become part of a world they just live in? Mm-hmm. It's just natural to them.
Why has, we have heard about technology having the promise to change education really since 1970, when the computer first came into existence. I remember when I was in graduate school, they talked about there was, programmed learning, and that each kid would have an individualized curriculum that was completely tailored to his needs. And yet that was 1970. It is a half century from there. And we have a lot of teachers who, they may use a PowerPoint presentation, but still we've got the sage on the stage and discussion groups as the predominant instruction. Why do you think schools have been so slow to change to technology?
A lot of it lies in finding innovative ways to incorporate it due to cost. I think over the years since I've been in public education, the amount of funding has gone down annually, every single year. My whole entire career, regardless of states. I came from the state of Colorado. They're facing the same kinds of budget cuts and challenges over that span of time. So it becomes very difficult to fund innovation unless you think creatively or get outside the box and find ways to have students access technology or bring their own technology into the school environment.
Help me understand that. I mean, I know, you know, way back when Apple donated millions of computers to schools, and there have been these, there were these computers in the classes, and they there was always a joke that said the, you know, the apples got planted, and then they, you know, they dried out from lack of use. You know, is it really equipment? And America does, we spend number one in the world per capita on education, you know, and computers, you know, are pretty darn cheap, you know, the, you know, these days, and even networking them is not. Is it really a budget issue when there is money for, you know, $165 million school plant? Is there really not money for, you know, a $200 computer per kid, or, you know, something like that? Is it really technology, or is there something else going on?
I think it's a combination of things. When you look at building facilities, you can go to the community and ask for bond money, which is simply money that voters will approve within your local school district to for bricks and mortar, to physically build the plant. And then once you get past that point, you've got the bricks and mortar, the building's built, you have to go back and look at, well, then how do we staff that building? And raising money or seeking money for that comes down to a parcel tax. We'll do that within your district. You can raise revenue to pay employees or pay for equipment and other things through that. And so we're limited on our means of income. And the other thing that's really tough with computers is they have a short shelf life now, about 4 to 5 years. And then all of a sudden the device and the software changes, driving you to have to put another investment into new equipment.
You're talking about, you know, parcel tax, additional taxes, but California, for example, has the highest tax rate pretty much in the country. The regular state, you know, income tax, property tax, you know, and it's been 30 years since Prop 13. I mean, the average homeowner, you know, is going to pay $5,000-$6,000 a year in property tax. Isn't that supposed to pay for kind of basics in the computer, like basics in the school, like a $200 laptop per kid?
I think you all that comes in your general fund budget, but any school district anywhere in the country or any state, your employees consume about 85% of your budget. And that's just the reality of it. In order to find or seek quality teachers, I think it's very important that they have to be compensated. Most teachers I hire have a master's degree, highly educated. They've invested a lot of money in that education. And even with salaries today, which have in some cases crept up a little bit along with the economy, they certainly haven't kept pace with the private sector, nor will they ever keep pace with the private sector. But I still have teachers who can't afford to buy a home. So they get into the profession because they have a passion for making a difference, working with kids. And so as you look at a general budget to fund your school district, it's really hard to balance all those needs with the fact that 85% of that fund is going to go to pay your employees to be there.
Let's focus on the core question that we have, which is, you know, what is it really like to be a principal? But first, let our listeners know you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Mark Brewer. He is the principal of American Canyon High School in American Canyon, just north of Vallejo. And let's turn back when you first became a school, either administrator or principal. What's something that surprised you about what it's really like?
The surprise for me was just the scope of the job, all the things you manage within a day. As a high school administrator, you step into a role. I started as an assistant principal. My first year, we had a school of about 2,000 students, and I had about 1,200 of them for discipline and attendance. And that's kind of the place where you start your career as administrator typically. But it is a great place to start your career because a lot of people view moving into administration is leaving teaching. I don't. I just teach different lessons in a different context. And discipline and life lessons are a great way to interact and work with students. I still am involved in discipline today. But I think the big eye-opener for me was how hard the job is, how big it is, how complex it is. It's very political. It's very locally controlled by parents. You've got an interaction with your local community, the broader community, the national government, state government. There's many factors that play and interact with public education. So as I've grown into this role and learned over the years, and I'm still continuing to learn, I've noticed a sense of developing myself into a different role as a leader of a school. And that role continually evolves depending on what context I'm working in outside of the school and around the school.
And let's talk about the disciplines, talk about the politics, let's talk about the rules and regulations. So, discipline. I mean, back, of course, you know, the cliche is when I was in school, you know, I was bad and I wouldn't sit down and the teacher sent me to the dean's office, the principal, you know, and the dean would say, you know, what's the problem, Martin? And I said, well, I'm just bored. I can't sit through algebra anymore. I can't. And then the president would say, well, you got to be good and, you know, you have to behave. You need to learn this stuff, and they would send me back to class. How different is it than that?
I think parts of the system are still there. There's still an avenue for teachers to send kids down to the office when they're misbehaving. What I see evolving is that teachers are learning to relate with kids better.
How about you?
How
about the principal?
Curriculum. And what my
you,
role?
Yeah, what,
just
so
as
let's
me.
Say they send, do they send kids to you or to assist? You know, you said you spend a lot of time on discipline still.
Yes, in the context of where we're at staffing our school, we have three small learning communities within our school, and I have two assistant principals, each that direct one of the three, and then that leaves me with the third. And within that context, we each take care of the students within that group because it kind of pares the school down to a smaller size,
right.
Gives me about 500 students to deal with,
right.
And then I can develop relationships with those students.
Mm-hmm.
So in my role, I do see kids. They do get sent to my office. Because of the structure and design of our school. So when I see them, I always work on developing positive, strong relationships with them, finding out the root of the problem.
So what would you do? Let's say I got sent to you and I you know, the teacher's fed up with me because I keep fooling around in class. I mean, is that typical still? I mean, that's
very typical.
Okay, so I'm this monster kid and I keep fooling around in class and the teacher's just had enough and sent me to Mr. Brewer for a remedy. What do you, role play, what would you do with me at that point?
At that point, usually I just start with a conversation with a student to find out what's going on. A lot of times it's just finding out what's driving the behavior. Behavior in students, I find, is always driven by something.
What do they say? What's driving the behavior? What would you ask? Let's role play. What, you know,
student engagement. Typically,
so,
they're bored.
Role
they
play
really
both. Okay, so they come in and they say, I'm bored. Now what do you do?
I ask them questions, leading questions. I try to develop a conversation. Well, what would change that? What would make school more interesting?
If it was like the teachers were more interesting, it was boring, it's hard, it's boring, what would you then say?
How can I help them? A lot of times students are looking for help. I'll say, is there a way I can help you? Do you need help with a certain subject or a topic? Do you struggle more in one class versus the other?
And what are they?
Are you having
they...
difficulty with a relationship with a teacher?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that happens. Very good teacher, great with kids. For whatever reason, that particular child doesn't interact well with that teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be a conversation with the teacher about moving them to a different teacher who they do connect with for whatever reason. But it's the human condition. It's the relational condition between student and teachers. Teachers who foster positive relationships, principals who foster positive relationships with students, that allows you to get traction because you can move students in a direction towards success based on the fact that you have a relationship with them. They know first that you care about them and that you want them to find success.
You said we said we were going to talk about the discipline, we're going to talk about the politics, and we're going to talk about regulations. Let's turn to politics. Give me one. I want my listeners to have a vivid picture of the kind of political issue that you have to grapple with, which is, you know, one of the things that makes, you know, 1/5 of all principals leave the profession despite the prestige and money. Give me an example of an actual political problem you faced.
In the past, one that I faced before is a key issue for all schools: separation of church and state. And having encountered a student in Colorado that made a choice as a valedictorian to give a speech that deviated from the correct political context for a graduation venue and drifted into another topic that none of us were aware of until they were standing on stage and actually decided to deliver this religious message in front of about 6,500 people.
Right, I see.
And in that context, I had to make a decision, how do I deal with that? And in that particular case with me, that ended up leading to a long, drawn-out political process. It was actually a case that went before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court denied to hear it, and it finally came to rest after 3 years. But there's always things politically charging people's beliefs about school, what they want from school. You deal with individual parent groups that have questions about curriculum, questions about content. What are you teaching my child? Why are you teaching my child that? You obviously run into the context around discipline that becomes political because it might be they're unhappy with how we chose to resolve an issue. So then that becomes a progression. They'll want to see the director of secondary schools. Mm-hmm. Then they'll want to move that to the mm-hmm. superintendent. Potentially, they may want to move it to the school board. Mm-hmm. So there's all that context you're operating in, trying to make, in my view, I always think about what is the actual best decision for the child? Mm-hmm. What's going to be the best thing to help that child move forward, help that child get past whatever indiscretion occurred, mm-hmm. because indiscretions are going to come. They're kids. They're trying to find their way in life. So our role is to find meaningful consequences that work for the child, mm-hmm. that have sense, make sense to them in essence, that if they do something wrong, there's a logical consequence to follow it up.
I would gather that not all the political problems are related to a problem, some screw-up, but simply competing interests. We know, for example, that in America, for right or wrong, sports is about great passion for students, for the parents, for the community. And for others who are more academically oriented, they say, what the heck do we need such a big sports program for? You've got a beautiful facility there in that American Canyon High School. Is there any conflict, we're talking about political issues. Is there an issue between the sports people, if you will, and the academically oriented folks in terms of allocation of resources, et cetera?
I think as far as allocations of resources, right now we fund sports through other mechanisms. We get parent support and help through Booster Club. All high schools rely on Booster Clubs to find money to provide transportation. There's a transportation fee associated with athletics. So it's really separate financially.
Interesting.
It's not totally, it's not supported by districts
really?
Anymore. They support part of that program as they can. It certainly is not in the proportion to what we do to promote our number one mission, which is educating students.
So that's why we're getting the 85% of all the education dollars are to pay for personnel.
Yes. And so districts as a whole will pay someone to coach. But the pay a coach receives for the course of a season and the hours they put in, literally, if they break it down, is about a quarter an hour at best.
I believe it.
Maybe 15 cents. But I believe this, the value you get out of teaching student athletes, they're a student first. The draw is that athletics teaches them many valuable lessons about life and how to work on a team, how to learn better, how to rely on their friends. So in the context of schools, I find it invaluable because that's where kids connect, whether that be band, choir, performing in a play. All yeah. those venues and avenues yeah. come in the context of really a broader athletic program, and that really ties kids to school and gives them invaluable lifelong skills.
You know, one of the political pressures that principals are under that has gotten highlights in movies like something Waiting for Superman, etc., is the difficulty of getting rid of an incompetent teacher. A teacher may have been competent during the first 2 or 3 years and gotten tenure, but then, you know, time has taken its toll, whether it be their age, the children, they just get burned out. It's a tough profession. How political and how difficult is the issue of dealing with a teacher? Because the union does provide a lot of layers of protections to ensure that teachers don't get fired too quickly. Tell me about that.
The trend I find with the unions I've been associated with, including the association where I work in American Canyon, is that the union leadership has really moved to a position that they will not protect bad teaching and bad behavior on the part of a staff member. So what I find is through the evaluation process, really, I get a lot of support around bad behavior or poor teaching. And then there's a system to deal with that. And part of it, too, is I think I have an obligation as a principal to work with that teacher to find success. Whether they're burned out or whether they're tired of teaching, there's a part that where you can sit down and coach them into thinking about, do they need to do something else? Mm-hmm. Is this the right profession for them? And also, what I find in my work that's successful is people, no matter what situation they're in, if you treat them with dignity and respect, and the fact that they are a human being, they are trying their best, keeping it in that context that you value them as a person, yet work with them around the evaluative process of I'm not talking about you as a person. I'm talking about your ability to transfer knowledge to students, and how can we improve that? And in my career, I've found great success with that. I've found teachers willing to listen because they don't feel attacked. And then also, what can I do to help them? What resources and tools do they need to re-inspire their career, to reconnect them with kids? And I look for those venues and avenues to help them.
Off the air, you asked me to ask you about something. You said that the biggest challenge you're facing is not the unions, it's not the kids. It is what you call just the increasing mountain of state and regional and federal rules, regulations, laws, No Child Left Behind, now the Common Core Standards are coming, and a whole, you know, just mammoth, literally mountains of regulations and data. So I'm asking you about it. Now tell me about how that is keeping you from providing the quality of education you would like to provide for kids.
I think in the context of education, again, it's become very politicized, and easily so. We're publicly funded. It's a public institution. So we're coming on a presidential cycle. I'm sure we will hear about education somewhere within the layers of the economy and the recession and things that aren't going so well. We'll hear about public education. But what I've found is good intentions gone bad, and over-legislation. They continue to just legislate, 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 thinking that if we continue to put more restraints and confinements and controls and standards and pacing guides and timelines onto schools, they will improve. And I don't believe that. I think you can cut 50% of what we teach with kids out of the Common Core and find success.
Let's define the Common Core. The Common Core Standards is now adopted by nearly all the states, and it is a new, ratcheted up, much more rigorous, much more difficult curriculum. Tell us what the Common Core Standards, and if you can, give us some examples of the kind of things that may make our listeners realize how challenging and difficult that stuff is.
I think what comes with it right now, with the Common Core, they've really gotten tight around literacy. Obviously, the most important thing. I do believe this. If kids read well by the fourth grade, typically you can track them. They'll graduate high school and find success. Because once they leave the fourth grade, they're no longer learning to read. They're reading to learn. So literacy is a big piece of the Common Core, and they started with English standards first.
But nobody would object to that. There's a lot of things that were eye-openers when I was looking at the Common Core, like for algebra or whatever. Tell us about the part you said you'd cut half of it, and it would be, what would you, you know, tell us about the half that you'd cut.
I think it's getting an example of this. I sat down with a group of our math teachers, and we delved into the Common Core, because obviously they're experts in that subject area,
right,
and wanted to look at what was coming.
Right.
And I asked them, what if you were to look at this group of standards, and what happens is you'll have a standard, and then below it you'll have all these other pieces that kind of fill in that standard. So one standard can grow to 10 expected benchmarks or outcomes.
So it could be like, I was looking, for example, so it could be graphing the parabola, and then underneath there would be a parabola with two components and an X and Y with a subcomponent of simultaneous equations. I'm making this up, but it's something like that. Is that
absolutely
accurate?
Correct. It just layers and goes down deeper and deeper and deeper. And so what I do is ask teachers, well, what out of that truly is essential? And probably as you get down those layers, there's some things in there that aren't essential that teachers will say, well, they really don't have to do this to progress, but yet it's embedded in the standards.
How much flexibility do you have? I know now schools get audited. Again, part of the layers is there are state auditors and federal auditors and Williams Act auditors. And, you know, if you say, you know what, I'm making a decision as a principal that, just, you know, using your words, half of what's in the Common Core Standards doesn't need to be taught. Could you get in trouble? How much flexibility do you have in implementing No Child Left Behind, the Common Core Standards, so on and so forth?
I think you have a lot of flexibility daily. But what you need to make sure happens is that you can demonstrate learning at the end of this.
But all learning, isn't the exams
right,
require all those, knowing those standards?
No, they don't test kids on all the benchmarks or standards.
So they're
that
teaching
doesn't
the
happen.
Standards?
So right now, STAR testing, CST in California, does not cover all of the standards that are listed in the California state standards. It covers parts of them.
I see. Okay. Let's go back to some basics. Well, let's talk about No Child Left Behind a little bit. That has changed everything. It has, I mean, tell me if this is accurate. No Child Left Behind is a federal mandate that basically establishes very serious carrots and sticks for improving the achievement of the lowest achieving kids to make sure that everybody meets basic competency, but there are very few rewards for going, you know, well above or whatever. first of all, is that accurate? And second of all, how has No Child Left Behind affected the way in which you can be a principal for better and for worse?
I think it's like anything. It's got some good parts to it. What I did like about No Child Left Behind is that it brought all states into alignment to say that at some point we have to assess kids' learning in some meaningful way. I think when you're left as an individual state to decide what that test looks like, that's where it got muddy for me, because every state is now defined and written what they believe is the right test to assess their kids. So that's kind of spun things out of control. You have all kinds of different assessment tools out there. And in the state of California right now, I find it really unreasonable to look at a 14 or 15-year-old high school student and put them through a testing regime in the spring, which really takes a total of about 16 hours.
Wow.
And it goes against all definition of what we would define as good teaching and learning, because we know a 15-year-old child, there's all kinds of research on brain development and where they're at intellectually, that to sit them through that kind of testing 3 hours a day, 4 hours a day for 4 or 5 days straight is not good for them. They will not produce, because they're going to close down after about the third or fourth hour.
And ironically, when they say they're interested in celebrating diversity, there's no diversity. Everybody, special ed kids, kids who are newcomers to America, must take the same test as a super, you know, brilliant gifted kid. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's a level playing field, and in the United States, it's level, because if a child has an address, we will educate them. I think that's the greatest thing about our system. We do not turn anybody away. Everybody else turns people away. They turn them away, they track them, they put them into other kinds of job venues, and they do not educate them. They only pick the best of the best, and then they educate them in a very disciplined system that's very rote and traditional. And I think they leave other countries with knowledge. They're top 10% of their students. But I don't think they leave as innovators and creators and extenders of knowledge. I think they just leave with knowledge. And in the U.S., I believe we create innovative people that leave our system.
And that sounds really, you know, of course, inspiring. How do you feel when you read in the newspapers or hear again and again that while America spends number one in the world per capita on education, we rank number in the international comparisons, despite the teaching and valuing creativity, etc., we rank overall, now this is not just cherry-picked 10%, we rank number 23, we're tied with Poland, and Shanghai is number one. What goes through your head and your heart as you listen to that?
I look at the reality of what we're comparing. I would go back to the fact that we're not comparing apples to apples. We're comparing apples to grapes and oranges and other things within other systems. Mm-hmm. Again, if you took the top 10% of all the students in America academically in a high school and checked out their ACT, SAT composite, their graduation rates, and compared them internationally, I think we'd rate right up at the top. I have no doubt.
You've taught me something. The other countries only include their top 10% of kids in those testings?
Most countries, if they're not educating everyone, there's a whole segment of their population that's never in school and never tested.
They're only educating 10% or so countries? I didn't know that.
I would say, I don't know the accuracy of just 10%, but I can tell you this.
Or even 20 or 30, yeah.
It varies depending on the country you go to study, because they don't always put all of their children in every country in school.
Let's turn back to we only have a few minutes left, so let's turn back to the real just day-to-day nuts and bolts. What is your favorite and least favorite thing about being a principal at American Canyon High School?
My favorite by far is the students. We have a great.
What do you like about
population.
What do you like about students?
I like the diversity. Mm-hmm. We're only about 12% white in the school, which puts me in the minority. Mm-hmm. It's a position I haven't been in the past, but I enjoy it because of what I learn from the diversity that comes to our school every day.
And what have you learned? What have you learned about from the diversity that comes to school every day?
Watching them interact with each other. They're truly good friends. They've grown up in this small community, come through elementary school together. So we really don't have racial lines. We don't have any racial tension at this point. Our kids get along with one another regardless of race. And I think that's an invaluable lesson for our whole society. We also immerse them in a program of project-based learning where they do work in groups, where we do allow them to interact and create their own learning environment and learn from one another. And I'm always inspired by watching our students in that context because they just do a phenomenal job.
Before turning to what you don't like, let's stay on the positive for another moment. What's something else you love about being a principal in American Canyon High School?
I love the way our teachers have embraced innovation. The staff that we've hired and that's come together there, we're starting with seniors for our first year this year here in about a week. We'll be a full four-year high school because we grew from freshmen and sophomores. And I'm really proud of seeing the faculty there expand their ability to innovate and work together and collaborate. And they're truly changing how they deliver curriculum to our students. I see it every day. We have one-to-one computing model where kids bring their own devices to school and interact with those, and our teachers embrace that technology within the context of relevant, meaningful 21st century learning. And that was a big change for staff when they came to American Canyon, but they've grabbed that innovation and they've run with it, and they're creating a different kind of model for learning in the 21st century, and it's been great for our students.
Let's keep the balance on the positive. So we've got two positives. Let's only have one negative. What's your least favorite part about teaching at American Canyon High School?
To tell you the truth, I made a real conscious choice. I left the private sector to go into education. And for me, best choice I've ever made. If I went back now and had it all to do over again, I'd do it all over again. Absolutely love my job. And to me, the negative things that come about are kind of just daily things that surface, whether it be a parent that I have a negative interaction with or a problem I have to solve that gets pretty contentious, people want to argue about it, or working sometimes with parents where you can't find a resolution, even at your best effort, and so you have to seek other help, and it kind of moves through the district. So those are the things that some days kind of bring me back, and I just say in my mind as I'm going home, wow, that's tough to deal with in the context of I want all kids to be successful and learn. There's setbacks, I think, that happen every day for a principal. And for me, it's how you manage those setbacks and allow them to be an opportunity for you to personally learn and grow, and hopefully that I can continue to innovate and problem solve in different ways that fit the context of the 21st century.
And the last question kind of is a kind of fun thing. Now, imagine you were you were Arne Duncan. You were the U.S. Secretary of Education. What would be your one, and you could, let's say there was no politics. This is radio. We can have fun. You could pass one edict. You could make one edict, and it would, you know, for to improve education, what would be your edict?
My edict would be this. I would want I would want one test nationwide that's given on one day that students can complete in about 3 hours, similar to the ACT, mm-hmm. that would assess them in basic literacy, reading, writing, and math. And they would sit for 3 hours. All students would be assessed on the same tool. ACT and SAT works brilliantly for a predictor of success. I believe we could develop a tool nationwide that would give us an analysis of success, a formative assessment that we could turn around and get the data back within a month or less so that it would be meaningful and we would all be on the same playing field to know how are our kids learning as a country. Because right now, with all the different devices and tools out there in each state, we don't have that data.
You use the term formative. So in other words, it would not just provide a score, but provide feedback to help teachers change instruction to make it more effective.
Absolutely. Yeah, because formative assessment, getting teachers to do that weekly, daily, and through interactions and talking and teaching with their kids, there's huge power in changing how you instruct a cohort of students. Because from the time we get them in August till they end in June, when you're using formative assessment to drive instruction, you can get great value and increases in learning using that system. So if I was sitting in his position, that's what I would have developed for every state and every student in our country.
And I think you've probably given every listener to this show a nice window into what it's really like to be a principal. So Mark Brewer, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thanks, Marty. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. And Mark Brewer is the principal of American Canyon High School in American Canyon, which is a little tiny community, a very interesting community just north of Vallejo. Thanks again. You're welcome to either duck out, Mark, or you can stick around and watch me torture my listeners for the rest of the show. Anyway, actually, you know what? Let me stick around here for a moment or two.
Okay.
Dear listeners, if you've been listening to my interview with Mark Brewer and you have a question or a comment about what it's like to be a principal, we obviously had to go off that to a little bit about what's it like in the schools today. If you've got a question or a comment, we invite you to call. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415 841 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And as well, this is as good a time as any to issue my usual invitation to you in the second half of the show. If you've got career misery, you are unhappy for the lack of a career, a crappy career, a boss you can't stand, feeling meaningless, or even a personal problem that's affecting you in the workplace. It could be a drug problem, a relationship problem. You're homeless and sleeping in your car, smoking a joint, and you don't know how to get out of it. Whether you're a clerk or a CEO, I usually can help you at least take a baby step forward, if not a giant step, doing what I call a three-minute career makeover. The phone number is the same phone number for that. If you would like one of those prices, certainly, right? Zero, zippo, nada. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go right to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello.
Hello.
Hi, it's you.
Oh, hello. How are you?
I am well.
Interesting show. Thank you. You were. I have a comment, and I'd like your reaction to it. You were talking about international comparisons and how the U.S. tends to score lower on most disciplines than other countries. And the example you gave was Singapore.
No, I didn't. I didn't say Singapore. I said, excuse me.
The United States.
Excuse me. I said Shanghai was number one, not Singapore, and that we were tied with Poland at number 23. Go ahead.
And yes, correct. And Shanghai, Singapore, same thing in terms of my example. If you look at the United States, the states that do really well on SATs and ACTs and other kinds, and even the international TIMS and the rest, are places like Iowa. And I think there's a real similarity there. You have reduced language variation, and you have much less sociocultural economic variation. You look at a place like Singapore, at a place like Scandinavia, which also scores very high. They pretty much are all speaking the same language. This Oakland has, like, I think somebody counted 48 different languages
wow.
that people are having to deal with. And you also have huge socioeconomic differentials in a place like Oakland versus a place like Scandinavia.
Interesting. Let's let Mark comment. Mark Brewer, you have any comment?
I think she's speaking to what I was talking about earlier, is that we're comparing very different segments of a community or population. And obviously, when you bring in language acquisition on top of a public education that we're going to deliver in a four-year package, or 12 years total in our country, it brings a whole new context. So sometimes you have to root down in that data and look at meaningful components of it to see truly how we're doing on an international stage.
Mm-hmm. And you had a question as well. What's your question?
No, I didn't. I just had a comment, and I would like your reaction. And your guest has made a very, very good point on air about how many of the other countries whose scores are higher than the United States on these international tests really aren't testing everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much for the interesting program.
And I thank you for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and my guest, Mark Brewer, principal of American Canyon. What's your question or comment for him, or would you like a three-minute career makeover?
Oh, this is a comment for Mark. Well, first of all, thank you so much for doing the kind of work that you do. It's pretty amazing, and I think that you have a I would never want to have your job for many years, but thank you for doing it. I have a couple of comments for you. I live in Columbus, Ohio, and I taught an advanced class with students from all over the school district, majority of them African American. But they were very tech-savvy, and one of the things that they did for their homework and just communication was they used Skype, and Skype is free.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if there's some way that if there's teachers who know how to use Skype, if there's some way that they could use Skype for the students to interact with in the classroom or outside of the classroom as a way of connecting with the instructor. So that's one thing I wanted to do.
Mark, what do you think?
Excellent idea, and we certainly use Skype. One of the things we did in our district is I meet with district personnel in meetings without driving now to the district office because they Skype me into those meetings. So a very powerful tool, and it is free, which makes it even better.
You have another question for him.
You can. Well, I just wanted to let you know about two other funding alternatives that do not involve the schools at all, and these are for schools and teachers who need help with some of their projects. The first one is called DonorsChoose.org, and that is one that is really targeted towards teachers. And it can be for anything from $500 to a couple of $1,000s. And as long as you can you can go through and show that you've done some work or what your school's about or what the project is, and the teacher can collaborate with you or some or the assistant the assistant principal, they're really great opportunities. The other one is SciFundChallenge.org.
Well, thank you very much for sharing those tips. Thanks very much for the call. We want to get as while I've got Mark here, let's see if we can get some more. I said one or two calls, but we'll cheat and go to the phone again. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko with Mark Brewer. What's your question or comment for him, or do you want a 3-minute career makeover? Hello, it's you.
Yes, hello. This is Ron from San Francisco.
Hi, Ron.
And I just want to say I'm a teacher, retired. I taught for 33 years, and listening to you, Mark Brewer, is one of the most exciting dimensions I have ever experienced in my entire career.
What made it exciting for you? Well, I'm delighted. We just gave each other a high five. What made that exciting for you?
The testing idea in particular, going with one test for the whole nation on one day in 3 hours, it has been incredibly damaging to American education, the kinds of SATs and PSATs and all of the rest of this that we put students through, and teaching to a test instead of teaching to learn. One of the most exciting things for me in my teaching was to realize that it wasn't go back to the Latin root of education, it's educare. And it means to lead out. And I found frequently that it wasn't a matter of my putting in information, but allowing information to come out of students. Some of the poetry, some of the writing that students expressed, I was amazed. I realized I didn't have anything to do with putting that information in there. What I did was provide an atmosphere in which they felt safe to let it out.
Well, thank you very much for the call. Anything you want to add to that, Mark?
Great input, and you kind of hit to the core of what education's all about. It's taking care of kids and helping them learn and create.
Let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. Mark Brewer, what's your question or comment for him, hopefully, rather than a 3-minute career makeover? What's on your mind?
You're talking to me.
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. Well, this will seem awfully trivial after such great comments. It's speaking English. That your principal says there is always political things instead of are, and none were instead, you know.
You know, when you're on the radio, you're having to think a million miles a minute. The greatest grammarian has been known to make an error. So, yes, I will agree with you that that is fairly trivial point.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. And, Mark, on that note, I find your grammar perfectly just fine. We all make mistakes. I give you an A for your performance.
Very good.
The missed, whatever it is, the number. What is it called in grammar? The misnumber is R. Is Father Nemko gives you full dispensation. Anyway, Mark Brewer, thanks very much for being my guest again on Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you. An absolute pleasure.
Good. And now we want to focus in the remaining 15 minutes of the show purely on you. If you do have a career problem of any sort, this is the time to call while the lines are available. These are perhaps the most difficult times. I know they for sure. In my perception, in the 26 years that I have been a career counselor, and certainly the last few years have been the most challenging and accelerating in their difficulty for the job market. In fact, there was a recent CNN poll that came out just 2 days ago that said that while the politicians are reporting things are getting better, that in a poll, a nationwide poll, most people feel their situations are getting worse, not better. So certainly you should not feel at all ashamed or embarrassed to be calling about a work problem of any sort, even if you've been well-employed in the past or never been. The phone number here for a 3-minute career makeover on Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-1450. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While I'm waiting for your calls to come in, let me share with you a few tips that I think are very important. So many people, whether you're young or in midlife or even in your 60s, you are trying to figure out what you really were meant to do on this earth. What should you be doing? What career changes should you be making? And there is a mistake that many people make that I want to alert you to. They tend to look too much to their past. What did I do in the past? What did I do well? And therefore, how can I build on that? That is like a handcuff. It chains you to your past. You may have, for example, been an insurance salesman for 25 years, and that you've had successes in that, or maybe you've also been a good mom or a good dad, and you think of that as one of your big successes. But should your next career necessarily shackle you to what you've done in the past? So I invite you, in addition to, yes, I do want you to look back to what you did in the past, but I also want you to look forward and ask yourself questions like this. What's something that I haven't done that is intriguing to me? If I was in a bookstore and I could get any book I wanted for free, or any section I would go, what section would I jump to first? What would I want on my epitaph that couldn't have been written yet, but in the next 10, 20, whatever it is, years? Look not just back, but look forward. We got a lot of calls, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. How can I help you? It's your turn on the air.
Marty, is that me?
It is.
Okay, Marty, thank you. I'm Ed. I'm a mid-40s career executive. Mm. And I recently completed an MBA course. Mm. And I'm kind of at a crossroads, if you will, and I'm not trying to sound, undeserved or whatnot, or, you know, it's not enough. But I'd like to see, what would you recommend for somebody such as myself who's looking to make that next jump up to the executive suite?
Great. Well, let's give you kind of a little test. I want you to self-score yourself on the following test. If you were faced with a group of 20 director level, manager level people, and you had been sitting in your office for a week developing a vision for where the company or the nonprofit or the government agency should go, you may have talked with them, chatted with them, and now you're called them in for a meeting. Do you believe you have the chops to inspire them to say, wow, what a great vision, I'm really eager to implement?
Yes, I do.
Good. Next question. Do you believe, these days, the days of where a leader, just like Mark Brewer was saying, a leader can no longer just get by on soft skills. He's got to have some technological savvy. We live in a technological world. To what extent would you give, do you believe you deserve an A, or at least a B, in knowledge of the technology, hardware and software, that's relevant to the kind of businesses or nonprofits you'd work in?
Yeah, I'd score myself with a very solid B.
That's wonderful. If we were to fill the room with everybody who has ever worked for you before, who you've supervised, what would they say would be your greatest strength and your greatest weakness?
Probably my greatest strength would be, taking care of the mission at hand and being responsible.
Mm-hmm. Very important.
And the greatest dissatisfaction would probably be that I tend to micromanage and take on too much because I want it done a certain way.
Okay. And so it is almost a cliche that the higher up you go, the more you have to delegate. Jimmy Carter got in trouble for micromanaging too many things, and people, made fun of, despite his other significant accomplishments, people remember crap like that. Do you believe that's something, in your heart of hearts, do you believe that's something you're going to change? Or in your heart of hearts, that's just hardwired in you?
No, I've been actually taking this on for the last year during this course, that I've actually been managing by not managing, if you will, trying to step back from it and let the folks that I lead right now make their own decisions and determinations with a little bit of input here and there.
What ends up helping that a lot is putting a great deal of your effort into hiring the right people. I understand you have to inherit certain people. But firing the ones that you believe really are not going to produce, that where you believe the amount of effort that it would take to improve them is too great relative to the opportunity cost, in other words, what you otherwise could be doing with your time, and taking the time to hire slowly. That's my next question. To what extent do you believe you are very good at the art of hiring wonderful people?
I give myself an A-minus on that. I'm pretty good at hiring folks that are long-term and responsible.
Great. Yeah, I mean, you've gotten an A on the test, obviously, but now I'm going to ask you the hardest question. What do you honestly think keeps you right now from being a world-class C-level employee, CEO, CTO, CFO, whatever it is? What is the one thing that keeps you from being a world-class C-level employee?
I think looking out at the financials more and you know, delving into those more are probably what's, you know, holding me back.
And is the best way for you to get up to speed on that is which of these three? Number one, trying to get a C-level job now and learning it on the job, on a just-in-time basis. Doing some reading of some articles on finance. Would it be taking a course in finance? Would it be getting doing some independent reading and getting a tutor to help you answer the questions? Somebody who already is, a CFO, who could answer those questions. What's the right way for you to build your financial chops?
Well, I've been doing a combination of all three, but I think the most important that I need to do next is, like you're saying, is to get a mentor that's a CFO or COO to guide me.
And what is the vertical that you're trying to aspire to in your first job? What industry? What is it? A nonprofit? A government? Where you eventually want to land? When do you want to land your first C-level job?
Wow, that's a tough one. I work for an international conglomerate now that's all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think my next step would be get a directorship somewhere, mm-hmm. More focused in the industry that I'm at.
Good. What is the industry you're in?
Water, high purity water.
Okay, good. So what if I said, I want you to do some digging to find who is the most respected CFO, not COO, that's just too broad, the most respected CFO in your space, in the water space, in the I'll call it the Perrier space, and then write, and maybe find three or four of them and write them a fabulous letter and tell them about this radio appearance that you just did, this phone call, and that we teased out the one missing ingredient between you and being a great director-level person, and that is financial chops. And you say, I've read this, I've attended these webinars, but now I really need a mentor. Might you answer these three questions for me as a way of starting that mentorship? Do you think that's a good idea?
That's a perfect idea. Thank you, Marty.
And I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you. Keep up the good work, sir.
I do my best. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello, it's you. Are you there? No, I guess that person is gone. Yeah, is that person gone? Yes, the person's gone. Okay. So let me give a tip here before we go back to the phones. I'll also give out the phone number. If you, if you've got a question or a comment, a question about your work life, whether you're a clerk or a CEO, nonprofit, for-profit, the key thing is you're unhappy with your career, with some aspect of your career or lack thereof, I can usually help by doing what's called the 3-Minute Career Makeover. 415-841-4134 is the number here at KALW. 415-841-4134. You are listening to Work with Marty Nemco. Okay, another tip. People are frantic these days to look for a job. And they go and they hire resume writers to make themselves look like they're better than they are. They go and they do video mock interviews, and every little eye is moving the wrong way. They're getting feedback on it. Well, there's another, perhaps easier tip that's fabulous for getting a job. Go to the exhibit area at a professional conference. The people who are in the exhibit area very often are the directors, vice presidents, the senior level people at dozens, if not hundreds, of companies that you could otherwise never get access to, and they're right there. Especially during the times during the conference when the sessions are going on, usually the exhibit areas are lightly trafficked, so they have time to talk with you. That's the chance to ask them for advice, to say, here's where I am in my career. This is what I think I'd like to do. Do you have any advice? By the way, advice is the great word. Do you have any advice as to what I should do? There's an old phrase in my business that says, if you ask for a job, you'll get advice. You ask for advice, you'll get a job. He doesn't feel pressured, or she doesn't feel pressured. So make a point of asking, you know, here's my situation. I would love to work in an industry like yours. Any advice? One more time, I'll give out the phone number. If you would like a three-minute career makeover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. This is the Procrastinator Special. There's only time for one more call. So I'll give another tip, though. When you finally have landed the job, there's a term that is really important. It's called pre-board. When your first 30 days on the job are critical. In fact, in many situations, I think this is accurate, that more people lose their jobs in the first 90 days, even of the so-called permanent jobs, than ever afterwards. You want to get off to a great start, if only because you never get a second chance to make a good first impression. So you've got to focus on your pre-boarding, and whether you're a CEO or a clerk, one of the best things you can do is to talk to your stakeholders. Make a point of having a 10 or 15 minute sit down with a coworker or two, with a customer or two if you're in a field that has customers, former colleagues of your boss. Do talk to folks and then create what I call a dream team of advisors. I'm going to make a very brief statement. I have asked the 10 people who I most respect in the world to be on my board of advisors. Six of them said yes, and we meet once a month by teleconference, and we each share each other's each one of us gets in the hot seat for 10 minutes. We share a problem that we're facing, and the rest of the group provides input. That's what you need in your job, especially if it's a challenging job. Get a board of advisors, some of those people who are in working with you, and those who may not be working in your organization, so that you're not having to do it all by yourself. Of course, the chief of my board of advisors is Google. When I run into a problem, the thing I'm going to do very often is Google, because that's the total wisdom of the world is then available to me, for free, 24/7. These are ideas, by the way, that come from my book, How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School, which is kind of a distillate. One-third of it is career stuff, and the other two-thirds is relationship advice and health advice, all the things that can impact indirectly on career. You might want to look at it on Amazon. Anyway, that is all the time we have today for Work with Marty Nemco. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, my guest, Mark Brewer, the principal of American Canyon High School, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do three-minute career makeovers on callers, and I'll talk with Bruce Tolgan, who may be the most knowledgeable guy in the world on the art of working with younger workers. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.